This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. All over the world, it is now acknowledged that the prevention and punishment of crimes cannot be achieved only on eyewitness testimony. Science is and has increasingly become an important tool to fight crime. And I have in the studio with me Dr. Jennifer Maley. She's a forensic scientist and environmental criminologist. And we're going to discuss the novel approach to crime prevention. Welcome to the show, Dr. Jennifer. How are you today?
Thank you. I'm good, thanks.
You know, when I was reading environmental criminology, I didn't quite know exactly what it was. Couldn't put my finger on what it really was. But it says it's the interaction between a motivated offender and crime opportunities. In layman's terms, what does that really mean?
Okay, so I think that one of the key differences between environmental criminology and what you would call more traditional criminology is that traditional criminology focuses on the offender and their mental state, whether or not they're mentally ill, and their propensity or their likelihood of committing certain crimes. And that makes sense in an awful lot of situations. But if you think about the policy implications of that, it means that anything that anybody wants to do about crime has to start with the offender. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you were talking about changing hearts and minds, if you like. Now, changing hearts and minds using tools such as education, awareness, etc., can be effective, but it takes an awfully long time, maybe a couple of generations, and isn't always effective. So environmental criminology expands that viewpoint somewhat. It doesn't reject it. It actually includes it, but adds to that picture the way that the person is influenced by the immediate situation in which they find themselves. In other words, the environment. Mm-hmm. And just one thing to clarify is that we often use the term environmental, talking about green issues. Yes. At the moment. That can be confusing. Environmental criminology can look at crimes to do with the environment, but not at all necessarily so. When it uses the word environment, it's talking about this immediate situation and how that affects our behaviour.
Right, so that's using behavioural science.
Mm-hmm.
What is that actually? How would you describe that? Could you give me an example?
So behavioural science is trying to look at patterns really on aggregate in the way that people behave. So what I mean by that is that if you've got a specific crime problem, such as mobile phone theft, mm-hmm. Which happens all over the world,
yep.
Then if you want to do something about it, then there's two people involved in that interaction. There's the offender and there's also the victim. But there's also, according to environmental criminology, the target, the mobile phone. So if you want to alter people's behaviour, like I say, then that's looking at hearts and minds. Mm-hmm. But if you want to simply stop the phones being stolen, then you just make them totally valueless once they've been stolen by cutting them off so they don't work, so then the thief isn't going to steal them in the first place.
Right, okay. So to tackle the problems at the root of it. Like, for an example, I mean, even in this country, a lot of crime can be attributed towards people who come from socioeconomically challenged backgrounds.
Right.
Children with disabilities who end up going to school and haven't been recognized for their learning disabilities and mm-hmm. end up, you know, dropping out of school and end up going the wrong direction. Mm-hmm. So going back to the root of those sort of problems rather than the crime itself.
It can be. I think that there's two aspects to those particular people. So they're unfortunate enough where they are at a disadvantage because of their upbringing. Yep. And the opportunities that life then affords them for jobs, etc. And if you like, a legal income. So yes, there definitely needs to be changes in policy, etc., so that they are recognised and they have more equal opportunities. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you could say, well, what do you expect? People need an income. If they haven't got a legal option, then at least some of them, if they can't rely on family, will tend towards the illegal options. But you can also look, using environmental criminology, you can look at the actual crime event itself. So if they are, for example, the people who are going out on motorbikes and committing the snatch thefts mm-hmm. of bags from cars, etc., you can do an awful lot to prevent that crime, to at least lower the numbers of that crime, by thoroughly understanding what it is that's happening during the crime event. Is it that there's a certain type of car that's more frequently targeted? Is it that there's certain types of bag that are taken while others are not? Obviously, bags that are visible are going to be the ones that tend to get taken more often, etc., etc. One of the things about environmental criminology that you come back time and time again is that you have to thoroughly understand a problem in order to do something about it. So saying that you are going to tackle crime, in inverted commas, is as not useful as saying that you're going to tackle cancer. There's actually many, many different types of crime, just as there's many, many different types of cancer, and they require tailored solutions.
So are you for punitive measures at all?
I am. I think that in some circumstances they can act as a deterrent. But what's interesting that I was slightly surprised at, actually, this was much earlier on in my career. I was involved in some research when I was at Loughborough University in the UK. And to cut a long story short, there have been very significant decreases in crime over the last 15 years in most industrialised nations. And criminology couldn't really explain why. It certainly couldn't agree on why. And I was involved in a study which tried to look at various explanations and test this empirically. And if you looked at countries such as the US, where prison sentences had gone up and the proportion of the population who were actually given prison sentences had gone up, that was not related to the specific crime types that had dropped. So it appeared that there wasn't a correlation between a decrease in crime and an increase in punitiveness, if I'm saying that correctly.
Yes. Got the message. But then again, you know, do statistics matter? I mean, government officials in this country say they have achieved a drop in crime rate by adding police officers on the streets and security cameras and barriers along roads to deter thefts on, you know, people's motorbikes, as well as by studying policing methods in cities like New York. How does that fall into the work that you do? Policing.
There are two different applications of policing that come from environmental criminology. One of them is called problem-orientated policing, where you would look at a very specific crime problem one at a time and try and come up with solutions based on, again, this understanding of exactly what is happening. So if you find that, for example, there was a great study that I love in the UK where a particular shopping mall in Leicester City in the UK was having a large problem with shoplifting. And so some research was done where some offenders were actually interviewed and asked to walk around various stores with a camera and a microphone and just talk us through what they were thinking, the choices that they were making, and what deterred them and what did not. They didn't like things like having to reach up high to get things off shelves, because that's a much more obvious motion. So maybe we would have thought of that. CCTV deterred some of them, but it very much depended on whether or not they believed there was someone actually watching that screen. What didn't deter them, which was interesting, was the big burly security guard standing at the exit to the shop, although you might expect that he would. Yeah. And when asked why, one of the teenagers put it brilliantly. He just said, "Listen, I'm here in my trainers, and I'm 18 years old. Look at that guy. He's 50, he's overweight, he's wearing shiny shoes on a marble surface. If I have to run, who's going to win?"
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a nice example of how we really need to be looking at the specifics and not making assumptions before we try and come up with solutions to these problems.
Right.
So going back to your question, the other type of policing that stems or is related to environmental criminology is intelligence-led policing, and that tends to be more suitable for looking at organised crime and gangs, etc. So you need the intelligence to be able to work out the structure, who's important, who's the person carrying the information, where the money's going, etc., and where you can hit this gang hardest, if you like. So there's the two different types of policing related to environmental criminology. they're quite different to each other.
I remember having the mayor of London did a show with him on the phone one day, mm-hmm. and he says that is one of the things as mayor he decided to implement, to bring out police force in full force, mm-hmm. To just their presence hopefully would be a deterrent, mm-hmm. and he says it has been relatively successful.
I think that for some types of crime it would be, because it would deter some types of offender. So again, if you have a problem and you find out by doing research or by looking at police records, for example, that the problem is mainly the crime is committed mainly by very experienced offenders, they are probably not as deterred by the presence of police personnel as younger offenders who are maybe trying it out for the first or second time. Mm-hmm. So it depends how experienced your offenders are, how specialised they are, and what tricks they've got up their sleeves, you know, to get away.
Yep.
It's been shown time and time again that the certainty and severity of punishment do have an effect on offenders' choices, but it's that the certainty that really makes the largest difference.
Yeah, but then again, also I remember having a criminologist on, and he says that certain types of crime happen in a certain period, and after which the fashion in which it's carried out it changes.
Yes,
and it's seasonal.
Yes,
you find a certain type of crime happening in certain periods, it dies off, and then it emerges again maybe a couple of years later. Is that what you find as well?
Yes, absolutely. So when you're trying to understand a crime problem, one of the things you've got to look for is the seasonality that you talk about, where you literally do a graph over time and say, well, when is this at its worst and when does it decrease? And what does that hint at? Why does it decrease? So if you've got, for example, a spate of burglaries in an area where many more people have just become employed, then you might think, hang on, that's strange, because gut reaction and maybe more traditional criminology would say that an increase in social conditions should lead to a decrease in crime.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think about it, if more people are employed, they're not in their houses anymore acting as the guardians.
That's right.
For those houses. Yeah. So the seasonality is something that happens. But there's also another type of temporal pattern that we find. And that's where certain products which are stolen come in and out of fashion, just like their legal sales cycles would do. So you see this with everything from mobile phones through to tokay geckos. I mean, we were talking a little bit off air about the illegal wildlife trade. And what you find is that if you looked at the legal, what we would call a product life cycle, where it's new and in an innovative stage, and then it gets to market saturation and then drops off, mm-hmm. because something else then follows which is more trendy, at pretty much the same time with a very, very small lag, you will often find that the illegally taken goods follow exactly the same cycle as well.
Interesting. Very interesting. When we come back, we'll find out more about statistics. The government in Malaysia has said that there was, crime rates actually doubled from 2000 to 2009, and that number of reported cases of violent crime nationwide has now declined sharply since 2009. But do statistics really matter? We'll find out up next. If you have a question for Dr. Jennifer, send it through. The number is 016-201-9000 or tweet BFM Radio.
This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture, and it's Meera Sivasuthi. We're discussing a novel approach to crime prevention with Dr. Jennifer Maley. She's a forensic scientist as well as an environmental criminologist. We were just talking about what an environmental criminologist really does and how that sort of fits into crime prevention. How does it fit into crime prevention, Dr. Jennifer?
Well, the basic stages of trying to prevent a crime are to understand that crime problem in great detail, like I've said, and then try and come up with various solutions, which is where you can get quite imaginative sometimes. So people will be very familiar with examples of preventing crimes such as bars on windows, gated communities, etc., which can be ugly or lead to, you know, a Big Brother type situation, which not everybody in society would want.
Well, we all live in gated communities today. I mean, most of us do, at least. And even if it wasn't a development that was gated, we have gated it anyway.
Yes.
Because of, you know, and I don't blame the residents, because a lot of this is happening without even government permission.
Yeah.
So is that seasonal, or, you know, in terms of prevention, does it really work?
I think it works to a great extent, yes. I think if you've got gates which are genuinely impenetrable and guards which genuinely check ID, etc., then yes, it works. Mm-hmm. If you've just got someone standing there not really doing their job, then no, it's not going to work. And people will soon find out that that is a weak point, and they will abuse it, and therefore crime will occur within that community.
Right. You were saying something about prevention just now.
Yes, sorry. So I was just going on to say that if you understand the crime problem in terms of who is the offender, what is the target, and specifically at what time and place do they meet in order for this crime to occur, you can start thinking basically, how can I change any one of those aspects? How can I change the place so that it's better guarded, for example? How can I even just change what we call the ebb and flow of everyday life so that the time is altered? How can I better protect the victim or the target? And how can I also deter the offender themselves? There's many, many different ways you can come up with these with solutions. And the sort of thing that people might think about, here's one example from the US. There was a problem with graffiti on some of the subways, and locking up the trains, etc., at night didn't actually help, because the kids still got in and committed the graffiti. So again, someone actually took the time and was given the funding to research this and to interview the offenders. And what it was that they were young gangs, and they wanted their tag, i.e. their signature, displayed around the city. So what the authorities did was they quite simply cleaned any carriages which had graffiti on them immediately, within an hour or two, and within a couple of weeks the graffiti artist gave up.
Right.
So that's nothing to do with bars and locks.
Yes.
In fact, the bars and locks didn't work. But finding out the motivation and then decreasing the reward from that crime actually stopped it.
Right. But ideally, who should fund all of this, Dr. Jennifer? Should it be government?
Mm-hmm.
Should it be the private sector? Who should do this? Whose responsibility is it?
That's a very good question. And it depends on the type of crime, I think. So if you look at the example of mobile phone theft, at the moment, the Behavioural Insight Team of the UK government, or also known as the Nudge Unit — are you trying to use behavioural science to sort of
yes.
increase behaviour for the betterment of society? They are talking about publishing a mobile phone theft index, which will actually tell the consumer what their risk of theft is by buying that particular type of phone. Now, they assume that the thinking behind that is not that many people will probably make a choice based on that, because people are obviously driven by how trendy or sexy the phone is, or
yes.
whether or not it's got the right capability. But what that's actually a market stimulation mechanism by which the insurance industry then gets involved, and the cost of the crime prevention is absorbed by the industry. Because if they don't absorb that cost, you can argue that some types of crime are what would in economic terms be an externality or a form of pollution.
Mm-hmm.
So just as a factory can have noise and air pollution, if you make a product, you know it's going to be stolen, you know your customers are going to be victimised, that then impairs a cost to society, then you can argue that that is also a type of pollution.
Are we very much ahead of our time, even discussing this?
It's pretty new in the UK and in the US, which is where environmental criminology first started. There's disagreement. I did some work on mobile phone theft. That's actually what my PhD was focused on. The industry reacted fairly negatively. They obviously denied responsibility. But there are some parallels. If you look at, for example, car safety,
mm-hmm.
which, and we now take it for granted, don't we, that of course when you buy a car it's going to have safety belts, etc. We also assume in terms of preventing theft of cars. A lot of cars nowadays are going to have immobilizers, central locking, things like that. That wasn't the case 10, 20, certainly 30 years ago. And there was great debate then about who was responsible for the car safety aspects. Now, what happened in the US was that what was called an enhanced safety doctrine was actually adopted, which basically said, accepting the fact that human beings are not perfect, that they are sometimes going to make mistakes and that accidents are going to happen, therefore the accidents are predictable to an extent, we have a responsibility, or the car manufacturers have a responsibility, to do something about that. And you can apply exactly the same logic to some types of crime.
And get it funded for initiatives like an environmental criminologist to come in and, you know, understand the environment and do more research on it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Or you incentivize it so that actually people are now choosing cars. So there's a car theft index, for example, in many countries in the world. And safety ratings and security mm-hmm. are one of the aspects that people actually base their decisions on. So it's become a marketable commodity
right.
of the product. So therefore, the car manufacturers don't mind internalizing the cost of the crime prevention
to make sure they're higher on the
index. Yeah, it's part of their arms race, if you like, against
yes,
each other.
Correct. That is interesting. Very, very interesting. We have a couple of questions here. We are very concerned about crime in this country. It's very obvious. Someone's texted in to say, have shows like CSI inadvertently, does it teach criminals to be more cautious and thereby makes forensic investigation more difficult? And if so, shouldn't these shows be banned?
That's a very good question. My honest answer is that I really don't know. I think you can, and I don't know if anyone's done any empirical research on it, but if not, they certainly should. You can imagine there's a scenario where some people will learn from the shows and think, right, now I can find a way around that. That particular technique, so I'm not going to get caught, I'm not going to leave as much of my DNA or fingerprints, etc. Mm-hmm. Whereas some people might watch it and think, okay, it's so advanced, I'm just not going to risk it. And I don't know what the majority is. And also, how do you measure crimes that would have happened but haven't?
Right.
So that would be very, very difficult to research.
Right. But, there's another question from Warren who said, I heard that there is no correlation between how well lit an alley is and the crime rate. And is that true?
It depends on the specific situation. So street lighting studies in the UK have shown that, again, it depends on the specific crime problem. If you've got a situation where burglaries were occurring and the light was actually therefore maybe, or sorry, the absence of lighting was allowing burglars to hide, then increasing the lighting has been shown to decrease it. But there have been some examples where if the problem was street robbery, it's made no difference. And that needs further research, because you assume it's because everybody can now see each other better. Mm-hmm. So I can see my potential attacker, but they can also see me and see whether or not I'm worth mugging.
Right.
We just don't know. We need to do further research and find out exactly why that happens.
Adam Lee wants to know, he said, I've read a book which stated that if one was attacked or chased by an assailant, he or she should not run to a crowded place, but rather go to a specific individual for help to stand a higher chance of being helped or saved. Would you agree?
I think it depends on the society that you're in. If you feel that you're in a society where people will stand politely by or be confused or shocked and therefore not know what to do, then yes, maybe going to an individual would be the better option.
Right. Another question. What is the validity of Malcolm Gladwell's theory that New York's crime reduced due to abortion laws rather than Giuliani's police efforts? What do you think?
We actually tested that abortion hypothesis when we did the testing. And I can, if that reader wants, I can send them the paper. But the names to look up are Graham Farrell, Mackie Saloni, which I can spell, and myself. And there was no correlation.
There was no correlation.
Well, there was some correlation in the US, but when you looked at other countries which had also changed abortion laws, it didn't fit in those countries as well.
Okay, all right then. So we will text you those references and you can probably go on and look at it. So just to come back to crime statistics, as I said earlier, our crime rates actually doubled from 2000 to 2009, and the number of reported cases of violent crime nationwide apparently has declined sharply since then. This is according to government data. Mm-hmm. Now, do statistics even matter?
I would argue that they do. I think that any government policy, and therefore policing efforts, has to start with the statistics, because you need to understand what is your worst problem. And then there's a debate about how you even define worst. Do you define worst in terms of just the economic cost or the fear that it instigates in society? Because there's two aspects to crime rates normally. There's the actual levels of crime, and then there's fear of crime. Now, even the fear of crime, for example, can really impact on society and also on the economic well-being of a country, because people stay indoors, they don't go out as much, they therefore don't spend as much money, and they might also be less productive in other ways. So statistics, really, really important for identifying what is worst and therefore what should you tackle first.
Mm-hmm. Well, interpretation of statistics is the other thing, isn't it? You need to interpret it. What is the best way to interpret crime statistics?
I think it very much depends on the source of those statistics as to how you interpret them. So one thing that
And who's interpreting?
Yes, absolutely. One thing that I find very interesting about the Malaysian context is that the crime statistics that are publicised and talked about are based on police recorded crimes. Whereas in many other countries in the world, those figures are actually complemented by representative randomised surveys of the population as a whole, which ask what crimes have you suffered, regardless of whether or not you reported them to the police. Excuse me. So then you can compare and contrast the two figures. And what you find in the UK is that different sectors of society are more likely to report some types of crime than other sectors are. And also that the variation in the difference between what's reported and what's recorded by the police actually changes depending on the government policy of the time. Mm-hmm. So you can check for situations where, for example, imagine you're a sergeant of a local area. You are given a KPI, if you like, a key performance indicator target of decreasing thefts. It's very, very tempting, even if it's not done deliberately, for the police officers who are then told about crimes by the public to just record one or two of them as robbery rather than theft. Looks like you've been successful. You actually haven't. It's actually just different recording practices. But one of the most important things that you need to understand in order to then come up with a coherent and useful policy to tackle crime, both prevention and detection, is to understand the bigger picture. Yep. So
no pun intended.
No, absolutely. So that's why you need to have, I really think it would be very, very useful for Malaysia to have an independent survey of
victims.
Yeah, a crime victimisation survey.
And what if there is a stark difference between reported cases by the police and the victims? And my gut feeling tells me there would be a very different set of statistics. So what happens then? Where is the gap? How do you bridge that gap?
I think you would start with looking at it positively, saying, okay, well, at least now we know. We've got an honest appraisal of the situation and we know where the differences are. Let's look at the specific crime types that are involved, the specific sectors of society where the biggest differences are. Let's ask them why they're not reporting to the police, or ask the police, why was this not recorded as a crime? Then you can move forwards from that point. But with any issue like this, it's always difficult, because I don't think it's helpful if people then start blaming, say, well, the government should have done it earlier, yep. or the police should do this or should do that. I think everybody needs to be positive and mature about it and say, right, well, at least now we have a starting point. Let's move forward from here so that in surveys to come, we see that gap decreasing.
And what can the average person do to make his or her neighbourhood or community safe, Dr. Jennifer? I think that's really the key question here.
Okay, I think in general terms, one of the key things is neighbourliness. It still goes an awfully long way. If offenders know that there's an ostracised community where they can get away with, yeah. if you like, almost anything they want, they will continue. And that area will become a hotspot, as we call it, for crime, or it can do. If people take sensible precautions themselves and look after each other, such as, you know, neighbours on holiday, make sure that you go in and turn the lights on and off so it looks like someone's home, simple things like that, or develop neighbourhood watch. Those things really can go a long way to protecting each other from crime.
Your message on environmental criminology, what would you like to leave us with?
I think it's a very exciting time in Malaysia. I think there's a significant amount of work to be done before crime rates and crime patterns are fully understood. But I think that's exciting. And I think that when people are talking about crime, it would be nice to start to talk about not only how we increase police numbers and forensic investigations, which always focus on clearing up the crime after it's happened. The issue with that is that the damage to society has already been done. The cost has been paid by the victim, at the least. Let's start to think about prevention, and let's start to think about how we can protect ourselves and future generations from suffering from the same sort of crime patterns that are being reported at the moment.
Just for the to set the record straight, and I'm not sure because I've not read these books. Victor has takes it in to say it's not Malcolm Gladwell that spoke about the abortion reduced crime. Mm-hmm. It was actually a book titled Freakonomics by Stephen Dubner and Stephen Levitt.
Yes, it is Levitt. Gladwell did another book which was called The Tipping Point, which is related to behavioural economics,
okay.
but not specifically to the abortion hypothesis.
All right, then. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Dr. Jennifer Maley, she's a forensic scientist and environmental criminologist on the topic of a novel approach to crime prevention on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.